there.
Hello.
Yeah, perfect.
Hello, my liver.
Right, we're not in the kitchen, we're outside. You can probably hear a crackling fire. It's nearly Christmas, and we've brought you here to the fireside to sing you a little song. I really backed myself into the corner there.
Jingle bell, jingle bell.
Oh, I was going for like more of a James Dean, slightly like two glasses of whiskey and like. You can't really hear the words, but you know.
Christmas.
It's the type of
wait.
It's the type of music that makes me think that, like, obviously everyone listens to it because it's of, you know, it's Christmas music.
It's the Christmas playlist.
Right? But when you listen to it, you're 100% sure that, like, when they was recording it, he was also leering at some woman in the room. Just like, you need a bit, I can't do it on a podcast, but like, a little bit of an eye and a lean and a silver bell.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a little bit. The same
creepy.
With...
Baby, it's cold outside. That is the most
Santa Baby is
song.
Like, I can't leave the house, don't worry, or my, I'm running away. Like, it's real.
You've spiked my drink. She literally is like, say, what's in this drink? And he's like, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's so cold.
And do you know, the Louis Armstrong one, and it's something that I could be completely wrong
about. Backdoor Santa.
I beg your pardon?
Is a song called Backdoor Santa.
No, no.
I'm a Backdoor Santa.
In the Louis Armstrong one, he's his like bit is like, drink some Swiss Miss or Swix Miss or whatever. And it's like a laxative that sponsored him or something. I could be, this could be out of my arse, but though, anyway, it's not a Christmas podcast because it's actually not December yet.
No, we've
just,
you're very keen,
gone slightly insane,
and I've embraced it. I can't fight it, so I'm gonna run with it.
Well, we were talking about, weren't we, that like Christmas is like, the actual day of Christmas is not as exciting as the lead up to Christmas, and the purpose of the lead up to Christmas or winter festival or all the other Christmassy, wintery festival things is like, hey, guess what? It's dark and cold. You need something to like mentally keep you going.
Yep.
I mean, the only thing that would make it more obvious was if you had like an advent calendar of vitamin D tablets. So it was like every morning you open it up, you get a little, there's no sunshine, so just have a little bit of vitamin D, make you happier. But we don't do that. We go like, hey, I'm just going to have a little bit of sugar and chocolate and be a little bit happy for 5 minutes and then be... That's my...
That's your winter...
Yeah, I'm not fun at Christmas. I sit around just telling everyone the sun's gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Enough. What are we talking about?
Fucking waffle. We are talking about... what was the official... I wrote it really well.
Resilience, perseverance, and hitting the zone of proximal development. Now, that just sounds so exciting, doesn't it?
When it really
does. When you say it like that, you think, this is a podcast I really want to listen
to. Hey, guys,
to.
I come here for the jokes and the 40-year-old educational theories.
Yeah. Oh, way older than 40-year-old.
When's Vygotsky?
Oh, my God. I just, hang on. I think it's 30s. I'm going to go with 1930s, but I'm going to check that. Check that fact.
Well... Yeah, people come here for...
Yes, mate. 1930...
What, that's when he was born?
No, man. He developed it the last 3 years of his life and he died in 1934.
God, it feels like he was scribbling that out, squeaking that out at the last minute to be like, I've got this really important idea.
Yeah, he didn't fully develop it, he just put it out there.
I mean, isn't that...
Fully developed by other people.
That's exactly afterwards. What we've done with this podcast. We've in no way perfected it.
No.
We just put it out. Yeah. Just anyway, so zone of proximal development for people. Let's do some stuff for people that might have come to this podcast or come to Forest School without doing the dry academic
teacher training.
Teacher training. So the zone of proximal development is the idea that the most effective learning takes place in this little narrow band. And if you think about difficulty in sort of like... like a bar chart going up, and it's kind of like too easy for say 60% of the activities can be, and then so that is not challenging, it's not stimulating.
Or you could just say, you could view it in another way as like a circle instead of rather like negative, too easy. You can just view it as like a circle, and in the middle of the circle, it's like stuff that a child, we're going to talk about in context of children, stuff a child can do by themselves, they can just do it. and a bit like you said the other day about something that they can do is something they can do even if they're ill, a bit ill, and they can still just pick it up and do it. Like they can, it's in their repertoire.
Like can an 11-year-old recite the alphabet? Yeah. Right, they could come in with the flu, and you're like,
some could.
Okay, a lot of 11-year-olds.
Can you walk? You can walk even if you're feeling you've got a bit of a cold and no one's really helping you, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stuff you can do. And then there's a band around that circle, like a bigger circle.
Are you going out now? So
yes,
it's a bigger circle.
A bigger circle. And in that bigger circle is stuff that a child can do with some kind of assistance and support, whether that be support from a knowledgeable other. So that could be
a peer,
it could be a parent, a teacher,
and it could also be a not a person. So it could be like, this is achievable.
No, I think it's got to be a person. The theory is that you watch and learn from the knowledgeable other.
Oh, okay.
And then and then there's another bigger circle
of
stuff that they just can't do, even with assistance. It's just like out of that realm right now.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that, as you're saying, the learning happens in that middle band of stuff that a child can do with some kind of support and assistance from a knowledgeable other. And the more learning that, more they're given those opportunities, the more the bigger the circle in the middle gets. So it's well, I've just added that on, but you know,
I like it as a metaphor.
It would get bigger. You're like, oh, I can do that stuff.
But the other ones do. The other ones move out to fit that. You know, there's always a zone of proximal development.
Yeah. So the zone of proximal development is that middle circle of stuff that's just kind of stretching your can do.
And I think that's where I prefer the, like, maybe this is like a hangover from. So I think state education here it views education very linearly, rather than, I think a circle is a nicer object. But the thinking in my head, it's a linear, like you're moving along the line and it goes too easy, too easy, too easy, perfect for learning. Too hard, too hard, too hard, and you move along that line, and you sort of, the stuff moves into the, you know, it's moving left into that. Now it's too easy.
Yeah.
And I think the overarching thing that I would say, and which is what's kind of led me to doing Forest School and to doing play working and to being there, is that I firmly believe that part of why child-led education works is because the ZPD is exactly where play sits for all children. And that you could, you know, I say this sometimes I said this to my own mother, who came to have a look around. She lives a couple of hours away, so she came and had a look around the session. She was going, well, she asked me how they learn history. And I was like, Mum, I'm really worried that that's what you think I do. Or that you thought that I thought this was what they were doing. You know, she was watching kids like climbing trees, lighting fires. And she's like, well, how did they learn the history? Anyway, and I said, well, you can be a teacher and you can work really hard to try and pitch a lesson at a like, oh, I think that will be just about difficult enough. And then you add into a layer onto that that's like, the differentiation that you need to do to go, right, well, for Gemma, that will be kind of challenging.
Yeah.
And Lewis is a bit slow, so he's going to need, like, coloured crayons. And, and you know, and doing that, and you're trying to do that for, like, 30 kids, five lessons a day, and then you multiply that into, like, well, I need a starter that's differentiated, and I need a main that's differentiated, and a plenary that's differentiated. Or you look at it in terms of play. If something's too easy, you stop playing it because it's not fun.
So you just change it and adapt it. Yeah. And
If something's too hard, you don't play it. Mm. You know, if something is challenging, that's exactly where children want to play. So I feel like you can do a lot of work putting this like lesson plan and perfect thing in, and then it's a little bit colder than you thought, or someone didn't have breakfast right, and your plan is now useless.
Yeah.
Or not useless. Your plan is now not as effective as it could be. But if you come in and you go, right, let's see, what do you want to play today? Where are you today? Mm. Just show me. Because they'll go and play stuff that is like, they'll go, right, it's almost like they're holding up a big sign saying, this is challenging for me. This is kind of hard. And you go, perfect.
Yeah.
Now let's step in and let's work with you and go, if that's kind of hard, let's get that until it moves into your inner circle or into your whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
And I think I've been talking for a very long time now, but
Do you want me to talk now?
Well, yeah, go on.
My turn to talk.
Yeah,
you
can have the stick.
I was just thinking about whether it's true that all play happens in the ZPD? Because I was also thinking about it in terms of adults, because sometimes you are in a place where you do just want to sit in that comfortable place. You do just want to do the things that you can do without any stretch or challenge right now. And I think kids do that as well as adults. You know, an example might be that you are doodling or colouring in. That kind of meditative, just, I am playing because I'm there, just colouring or doodling. And I doodle the same doodles now that I've doodled since I was about 13. And I know because I've got my diaries from then. Right. And my hand naturally makes the same shapes when I'm doodling. And I do this kind of weird, like, spiral thing.
Get into that flow state.
Naturally do that.
But flow state needs a certain amount of challenge. And yeah. I would say, I'm going to talk again. I'm going to steamroll all over you.
Well, you know.
Because I'm a man and therefore more important.
Get out.
That's not.
Get out.
of the world. I think that is.
Can I just finish my thought?
I suppose.
So that. Yeah, I can't now because you've talked about flow. Go for it.
Well, I think that is. I think you are still playing in your ZPD. I just think the ZPD is not a fixed place. So, like we were saying about. Can they come in and do it when they've got the flu? Can they walk? Yes.
Yeah.
But I think there's a much more subtle level to that, which is like, what is challenging for you when, if we're talking about children, on the day when they've had a good breakfast, they've had a perfect night's sleep, they've arrived with no issues, but then, and then that's very different to, I didn't sleep well last well because my baby brother was crying and, you know, there wasn't milk, so I've had to have dry toast and that's not ideal. And so, that's where the ZPD shifts, and like, I think when we're doing things like doodling or monging out with a TV show that you've already watched and you've been, you know, you're just going, oh, I've seen Futurama already, I'm just going to watch it again. You are still working that ZPD, but you are self-differentiating for like, actually, what's challenging for me? What's the enjoyable level of challenge right now?
Yeah, I guess so. Because I guess the zero challenge would be doing nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So either this is some time in which I am free to do as I choose.
Yeah.
I can either sit there literally doing nothing, or I can give myself a little bit of challenge by doodling and seeing what shapes I can make. Yeah, okay, I get that.
I've heard a very, now this is kind of rude.
Oh!
I've heard, I think actually it was in Nilay Csikszentmihalyi's books on flow. No, it can't be, he wouldn't have been this rude. The brain is an organ, and like all organs, you get more fun when you play with it.
Right, yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
And that idea that like, actually not using our brains isn't fun. You don't get any dopamine hits out of it. And in the same way of like, sometimes running 2 miles is hard, and sometimes getting up and walking around the village is, you know, we adapt that level of challenge. It's not always running 2 miles is always exactly the same level of difficulty to me. You adapt and you have different things. And when you're doodling, like if we can just go down that rabbit hole with doodling, it's self-imposed, so you're deciding how neat that doodle has to be, or how, you know, how focused you have to be with it. You could do like a real sloppy whatever, you'd still be doodling, and some days that might be as difficult as you want to make it. You know, you're on quite an intense phone call and you're just scribbling and cross-hatching. Sometimes I cross-hatch and just do darker and darker things, and it looks like I've got real emotional problems because the page just gets darker and darker as I carve it through the hole.
And you rip the paper.
Yes, and then you start on the next page. but, you know, you're self-mediating where your ZPD is. And I think then that this flows into, if we're talking about how does this come into our practice, is one, as I think I touched on, is being so really flexible with your planning and being really like, you know, I say it quite a lot, but meeting them where they are, not meeting them where they were, not meeting them where you think they should be, arriving and almost having a like non-verbal conversation of where are you right now, where are you today? And I think that's where, again, state schooling has this thing of like, well, we did that yesterday, so now we're going to do yesterday plus one, and then we'll do yesterday plus two. Yeah. And there's very little time to keep going. Oh, okay. Where are you? Where let's. Oh, actually, you've jumped ahead. Loads.
There's no trust in the child or the teacher at the moment in the state system, I don't think, because you're not trusting that the child is going to. Sorry, I'm just pausing because I'm getting more and more green ink on my hands.
Your hands are going green.
Have I got a green face?
Huh? A little bit on your nose. On both of your nostrils.
This is ink. It's
You've gone green.
Something about my person is leaking
green
ink.
Oh, it's plague. Yeah, you've got
it's
plague.
It's plague. Literally green fingers. So that trust...
Why are you rubbing your hand? You just rubbed your hands on your nose and your forehead. You look like Shrek before we're finished.
Oh my gosh.
Stop rubbing your face.
It's because it's on there and I need to get it off. Yeah, so
the trust
in the child that they will want to learn, like you're saying about the brain being occupied when you're using it, it's like at the moment that whole thing of like, well, unless you really push these children, they're just going to get like mentally complacent, overweight, flabby, unfit, like not even proper citizens of the world.
Oh, because, like they're not like that already. No, I'm joking.
You know, unless you do something to them, you know, they're going to do that. And show us that you're challenging them.
Humans are
them.
An incredible species in that, like, we play to learn, and we have done for, what's the human species, 100,000 years? That's how we have adapted. That's why we have dominated the planet, is because we play and we learn through play and we adapt and we do all this stuff. And then last 200 years... If you're just listening to the last one where we're breaking down schools and why they don't teach, you're well on board with me now. But going like, you know, this idea of if you don't push it into people,
yeah,
they'll have no motivation to
and
learn.
And also no trust in teachers. So if you, we sort of take a curriculum for granted now, but the national curriculum in Britain has only been around since the 80s. And before that, teachers were more free to teach what the heck they wanted. And so then you could be more... child-led in your approach, and there was trust in you as a professional to do that and to adapt, like you're saying, you know, oh, I've planned this because they were interested in that yesterday. Oh, they're not interested in it today. I'm going to change this, actually. Oh, you've just said something that's made me go off down a rabbit hole, and yeah, let's explore that right now. Whereas...
But I think that's
there isn't
I think they're parallel topics, but they're slightly different things, because one part of it is interest and following children's interest and going, that's the ZPD that is challenging and interesting. And the other bit is that you could stay on exactly the same track, on exactly the same topic, but move backwards and forwards and be flexible about, like, okay, we talked to you yesterday about, because you were interested in Henry VIII, and we talked about his six wives yesterday. And then you go, you do your starter, and you meet the children again, and you realise that didn't go in. And being absolutely able to go, right, actually... we're basically going to do yesterday again, or we might even go further back than that. So in the same topic and area, being able to go, oh, I think if you're a teacher going, oh, I think I misjudged the ZPD yesterday or today, and you know, I'm going to need to move this backwards and forwards to make it more challenging, less challenging. And also coming in and going, which is obviously, I think happens more times than people will acknowledge, is you arrive and you go, oh my God, you can already do everything that was on that I thought we were going to do. You have just done it in 5 minutes. Yeah, That's incredible.
Yeah.
And not going like, well, don't go too fast.
Yeah.
Right? You've got to slow the bright ones down a little bit so that you can
make
move
sure you've
as a
underlined
class.
The date.
Oh, fuck off.
Just, you can't do the extension until you've done everything perfectly.
Yeah. So that is the kind of crux of it. And then applying that to practice here... In the woods,
Raven's
shush, Mr.
Again.
Raven, is kind of so. Like I say, it is all child led, you know, and that varies from group to group, doesn't it? Sometimes that's child led in the moment, and we're arriving and you're doing this, and sometimes you're looking at it over half a term and going, you know, I've known you for 2 years now, so I might have more of an idea, but still being able to move that and shift where it is, and it kind of. I go back in my mind quite a lot to a conversation we had before where it was this idea of like, do you let children fail?
Yes.
You know, and the level of perseverance and I feel like it's hiding the fact that you got the ZPD wrong. If you arrive with a topic that children then can't achieve, you know, or an activity that, you know, they can't achieve. And rather than going, oh, right, this is the wrong activity for you right now, let's scale it to whatever, you go, yeah, but if I give you 8 crutches and I do the first bit for you, and then I layer that on top, oh, you've achieved it. You go, well, you didn't achieve it. You know, you've kind of like...
But if you're always giving them things that they can't do, then also they're just going to get cheesed
needs reflection.
Off and you know, and they won't engage. And they'll automatically assume they can't do anything because they can never do anything that you showed them.
Yeah. But I think there's a difference between... if I think about something... Maybe like whittling, like, you know, you're doing a, let's say making a spoon and going, oh, you saw the wood, you draw the spoon on it, carve it down, and then you make it thing it, you know, do whatever. And sometimes the right thing to do is to kind of go, oh, I've given you like a spoon blank.
Yep.
Can you now finish it? Or, you know, we've drawn the spoon together, and you there's always one way where you work backwards. So the children are doing more of the activity. The first bit is just, can you cut down the mallet, you know, cut with the billhook or whatever, and then you go, oh, can you saw the log and then cut down the mallet, and then it becomes completely independent. You're still making the same outcome every time, which I don't, my experience is that progressive learning isn't as impactful as kind of going the other way, where the end product is different each time, because you've made a greater thing. Always arriving at the same place. It's almost like running a marathon. Not running, you know, if you think of the finish spoon as the finish line of the race, and you start off 100 metres away from the finish line, and you run to the finish line, and then you start off 200 metres away from it, and you're still running to the same finish line, and you're 300 metres away, and you're running to the same finish line.
I don't know any child that would choose to do any of this things.
Okay, but what I mean is it's a very different thing to starting at the same point every time with, like, a lump of wood.
Yeah.
And the first time, you're just splitting kindling, which is, like, running forwards 100 metres.
Yeah.
And then you're making, you know, a feather stick, which is, like, another, you know, you're running further. So I think arriving, that's what I mean about, like, putting crutches on, because you're not moving the finish line. You're not changing the goal. And children are, it's a lot more difficult for them to reflect back and go, oh yeah, but last time I did it, you helped me with that, and you didn't help me today. That, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's a harder thing than,
yeah,
hey, look, I made a different thing today that was harder. That's a much bigger thing. Stop rubbing your face.
I found the source of the green ink. It was the Forest School Leaders backpack, where you ram the most random things next to each other, including, obviously for me, a hairband and a green felt tip without a lid on, I think is what's happened. So my hairband's got covered in green ink, and then I've been playing with the hairband. Now I've got green hands and a green face. I've got a green face.
It's going green.
It's going green.
You look a bit ill.
Yes. Do you want to talk about the whole, I don't know if we've talked about this before, about kind of climbing and physically challenging things in the woods. So we've got like, I've got various like obstacle courses and kind of wonky climbing frames that have been cobbled together out of bits of pallets and wood and stuff. And a tree house, a couple of tree houses with different routes in and out. And we have conversations with parents a lot about whether or not you assist a child with climbing up into something high, or whether you just go, well, if they can't do it themselves right now, then actually that is not something that they can do.
That sounds, on the face of it, that sounds quite
harsh.
Defeatist, maybe, that you arrive at it and, you know, you go, well, they can't do it. We're going home. No more Forest School. Too bigger. But actually, I think what we're talking about is a lot more of like almost hands-off guidance. So I would say there's a big difference between moving a child's foot with your hand and standing next to them and saying, "Can you put your foot on that step? Can you move your right hand up to that thing?" And I would say the latter, giving verbal, you know, kind of tips and that kind of thing.
And confidence boosting, because a lot of it is you can tell a child is physically able, but they are going, I can't do it, just help me, I can't do it, I'm scared. And you're like, yeah, I can see that you're scared, and that's okay, it's normal for us to feel scared, but if you know they can physically do it, to give them that kind of emotional coaching. I'm right here. Mm-hmm. I'm right here. You know,
and sometimes standing quite close, and I put my hands out so that I'm going, I'm mitigating the risk for you, right? You're not going to fall, because if you go backwards, you're going to go on to me.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that. So let's just focus on how are you going to climb up into that thing, or how
and
are you going to...
Sometimes that's enough, and that works. And sometimes that isn't enough, because that's the other difference, isn't it?
Yes.
It's about emotional resilience and persistence rather than physical. So some, you know, one child has given it a go, got really scared that it's too high, cried, had a meltdown, and then walked away from it. And then, having had that experience, the following week they go that little bit further without the crying, and then 3 weeks later they're just like zoop, and up they go, and that's fine. Which they wouldn't have experienced any of that progress if you had just helped them physically, or gone, oh, okay, you can't do it, walk away, as you say. You know, we wouldn't go, okay, no, it's not for you, you can't do it. And so I guess that's a good example of something that isn't in the emotional ZPD at the beginning of the process, that is way beyond the ZPD.
Well, that's kind of, I think that led quite neatly into what I was just going to say, which is that my understanding of the Vygotsky learning theory is that it's very much looking at academic learning or as you say, physical learning. And it's quite interesting to apply it socially and socially and emotionally to what's socially and emotionally difficult for children. Because with a treehouse or an activity that's on a table, if you're in a child-led setting, it's quite easy to walk away from, to go, I've had a good old go at this, and Gemma and Lewis stood next to me and they kind of coached me, but it, you know, you just get some children that go, not today. My little boy has now clocked onto the idea of, when I bigger, can I do this? And I go, maybe. And we've talked about, you know, that he'll be bigger next week, but also he'll be bigger in a longer stretch of time. So he's quite up for, oh, I can't do it now, maybe when I bigger. And you go, okay, cool. But what I was going to say was, like, tree houses you can walk away from. Activities, unless you're in a school where they're sitting down and next to you and saying, you must do the writing today, you can kind of get away from. But emotional stuff is sometimes harder to step away from. If you're not ready for a very challenging situation, like somebody shouting in your face because you have taken their thing, right?
Even or if a game that's very
or someone
scary
disagrees about
you.
The rules or those kind of things, they're much harder for children to put their hands up and go, no, I'm out. Because there's another player. The treehouse doesn't follow you and go, oi, you got to climb me.
Yeah.
But another child will follow you and go, no, we need to talk about these rules. We need to, you know, we're not going to carry on playing until you sort this out. And that, I think, is something that practitioners need to be mindful of when they're dealing with kind of social and emotional situations, is that sometimes the children just can't get out of them. There isn't an easy...
And I think that's that instinctive moment where you shift from going, okay, I'm adapting to the child, I'm letting them lead, I'm doing all that thing, and then you shift into, right, distraction time, why are you doing this? Who wants to bake a cake now? Who wants to, I'm going to do this if anyone wants to play, and then everyone, and you can almost hear the kind of little sighs of relief of those people that are like, oh my gosh, thank you for saving me from that thing that I couldn't do and couldn't escape from.
But as we're saying about the ZPD, and particularly we're thinking about perseverance, is when you, as a leader, start to see that situation arise again, is not immediately going, oh, little Jeffrey can't handle it when the rules are changed, so I'm immediately going to step in. Yeah. You have to let them try the treehouse again.
Yeah,
you have to go, okay.
Yeah.
You're gonna fall off this bike
again. Watch them flounder a little bit, which is hard. Definitely hard.
It's really
to do.
Hard.
Yeah.
But you know, they talk about it.
But you've got to remember to frame it as a denial for them. That's what I find easier to do. So it's really uncomfortable to watch somebody flounder. But if you don't, you are robbing them of an experience that's incredibly valuable for them, not just in that moment, not just about being able to use scissors or climb up a treehouse or sort out the argument with their friend, but long term, you know, you are building a person that is not capable. And so... because they've never experienced that.
It's learned helplessness, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the same as So learned helplessness can be, with all these things, I feel like the physical is a lot more easy to imagine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So learned helplessness is the child at the bottom of a climbing frame shouting, "Daddy, you need to put me in the climbing frame." That's learned helplessness, to not try.
Yeah.
To, you know, if they try and then they're like, "I can't do it," Daddy, that's a different thing. But the children that arrive at a challenge and go, "Nope, mm-hmm. you need to help me." But learned helplessness, social and emotionally, is the children that immediately come to an adult with everything.
Yep.
And that is one of the things that I do think a lot of schools foster in children is a learned helplessness.
We've had that discussion before, haven't we? About right. That's one of my favourite bits of It's Okay Not to Share, which we talk about all the time. But the chapter, I can't remember what it's called, but it was such a light bulb moment for me about assisting children dealing with disagreements like that, or, you know, they so and so push me.
Yeah.
Gemma Lewis, they push me, or they splashed the water and it went in my face, or whatever. And
a deep breath before when they come to that. You go.
A traditional approach might be, okay, right, I'm coming. Don't throw water in her face.
I shall come in, kick the door down. I shall solve this.
Whereas the alternative theory is to go, why are you telling me? You've got to tell them. So giving the victim a voice is kind of how Heather Schumacher defines it. And again, once you put it like that, it becomes less about, oh, I'm not helping them as a practitioner and the adult. I'm not helping them. That means you're guilty. It's actually, you are helping them. You're helping them more because you're giving them the skills to be able to deal with it when you're not there. That's mm-hmm. the other thing, that you're not always going to be there for them. So to coach them through, okay, like the first few times it will be like, okay, I'm coming with you. I'd like, you know, you need to tell him, stop it, little Billy Bob. I don't like it.
He is a real piece of work,
Billy Bob. So, Billy Bob, stop throwing the water in my face. I don't like it. And then they literally kind of parrot it back. And they go, no, look at, now they'll sometimes say it to you. And you're like, okay, look at Billy Bob. That's the person you're speaking to. And you do, and it does work.
Well, I find and then, with that, there's a scale up of like, first one is like, I'll come and stand next to you and I'll say it. And the next one is like, you tell me the sentence and I'll go over and say it. So they practice saying it to you. And then you go, well, let's check what we're going to say.
Mm.
And then we'll go together and we'll say it. And then, you know, it's moving that ZPD of going, what's difficult?
Yep.
What's achievable but challenging?
Yep.
And let's move that.
Yeah.
Slowly,
which
catchy
was then
monkey.
A problem for my 5-year-old daughter, having been to our kindergarten and being kind of coached
just
in that system.
Just being in the best place.
But she definitely owned that skill. She couldn't do it, and then she could do it, and I saw her doing it all the time at home and at kindergarten. And the thing is that kids don't, in my experience anyway, go back to that, the example of Billy Bob thrashing the water in the face, if you give that victim the skills to, in a strong voice, stand their ground and look the person in the face and go, I stop it, I don't like it, Billy Bob doesn't go, don't tell me to stop it, and escalate the situation, which you might imagine with a teenager or an adult. Smaller children are kind of more used, I guess, to being told what to do, or they're so sort of, they just handle the truth. They're like, okay, most of the time.
And it's the same, it's a similar theory to I think most people now would maybe I've made a big statement here, that there used to be a very prevalent idea of like, you wait till your father comes home. And my mum was definitely raised with that, like her mum was not the disciplinarian at all, but what that teaches you is that you are not the person that you need to worry about. You know, that you are not I mean, maybe that's a bad example because of the disciplinarian thing, but Billy Bob is not learning that he needs to have any consideration for this other child.
Yeah.
He's learning that
if he does it, he gets told off by the adult.
By the bigger person. Yeah. So actually, the only person you need to impress is... The only person you need to kowtow to is the adult. When actually, you need to be going, you know,
I'm looking after my peers
saying a thing.
Yeah. Going back to my daughter to finish that anecdote, is that she then started school and she noticed a difference in the kind of ethos there, and actually said to me at home, she was like, school is different to kindergarten. I said, that's right. And she said, yeah, they, at kindergarten, we try and sort it out ourselves. And at school, they say we're not allowed to sort it out ourselves. We have to come and get a grown-up. And she gave an example of, you know, someone wasn't playing in the way that other children wanted to play.
Was it Billy Bob?
It was Billy Bob throwing the water again in the water area. And I thought, oh, God, that's really interesting. A, that it's different, which is maybe to be expected. But B, that she has picked up on it as like a major thing that's worthy of comment and discussion. But I thought, well, that's a real shame because she's obviously shown you that she's capable of doing it. But I guess if you don't have everybody on the same page, that's the other thing, isn't it? It's like
I guess
you're jumping
the,
between worlds, and some
it's
kids
the fear
are used
of
to that.
Worst case scenario, I think, there, in that if you said to a lot of adults, and a lot of, I've said this before, but I do really feel for mealtime assistants. Because in general, again, big sweeping statement, they're the least trained in childcare in a school.
And
you know, it's not
paid.
The teachers that have been. Mm. They're the least well paid. They have the least contact time with the children. Quite often it's, you know, grands or relatives or people that are coming in for break time in there. So they're not, you know, privy to years of educational training and encouraged to look into play working and all this stuff. And if you said to them, do you want the children to sort it out?
Mm.
The jump to is the worst case scenario of two kids twatting each other in the face and going, we're sorting it out ourselves, miss!
Yeah.
Bang!
Yeah.
And, you know, and actually, that isn't the case, you know, because that's a whole separate thing where you go, right, we can't hurt each other, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I think that's part of it. And I do, you know, I said before that in the last podcast, where I was saying that people who do forest school are in a privileged position where we're in schools and for the most part outside of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I know that some people have to kowtow to the curriculum, that's a whole different thing. But for the most part, we're outside of the curriculum, but we're in schools, and our job is, our mandate is we're going to assess what these children need and we're going to put that forward. And quite often people, I think, are embarrassed to say that actually what these children need is not to be able to name the six trees that are in our nature area. It's to be able to talk to each other in a way that's civil, or they need to be able to work something out when there's only one wheelbarrow and six kids. And you know, we should have a little bit more pride in the social and emotional learning that we're doing and the teaching that we're doing, and being able to go, not just going, little Sally has made progress because now she can recite the fire triangle, she can name things, and she can line up nicely at the gate. You want to go, Billy Bob was a prick when he turned up. And you maybe don't write this in his report.
No.
But and you go, now he at least sometimes asks children if he can join in the game. That's huge progress.
But that shift in perspective is so massive for so many educational practitioners.
Oh, yeah,
if you're only
huge.
Doing forest school all the time, then that is completely obvious to you. But if you are...
Who does other things?
If you are a teacher who has to teach their class, the national curriculum, 95% of the time, and then you take them outside for a couple of hours a week, or you are somebody who is employed for forest school, but you also end up doing loads of cover in the classroom. So basically most practitioners, or for anyone who's observing a forest school session, so there's lots of chat on support groups about that, about like, oh, I've been observed and this is what they've told me, but I've been observed by my boss who's nothing to do with forest school, they are like deputy head of the primary school or whatever. It is so difficult to see. It's almost, to us it's so obvious, and that is the kind of the point, and it's about children's well-being and all of those social and emotional aspects which are the key to being a happy and well-functioning human being, and there it's almost invisible. It's like invisible learning that you can't, and even when people do see it, they're like, oh, how are you going to evidence that? How are you going to evidence the social and emotional progression and the well-being?
Hanging my head.
You just can't. Just actually, it's about, and again, it goes back to kind of trusting the practitioner. And if there wasn't such a thing as Ofsted, and there was just general trust and belief that practitioners want the best for children in terms of, and as far as I'm concerned, like, they are talking that Ofsted's going to put more kind of well-being and well-rounded business into their inspections.
Oh, good. Let's dictate more stuff.
But you know, that is, I mean, that is the overall point of of any kind of childcare slash education is the happiness and well-being and, you know, social functioning of the child, because all the rest of it is extra, in my opinion.
And if I can tie it back, you know, back round in a sort of circle, because we've waffled quite a bit, but I think there's a lot to be said for the impact that one area can have on another. So if we're talking about ZPD and doing what's challenging, and we're saying that, you know, like we were saying at the start, when stuff's when you're burnt out, you go back to this, and because we're not putting as much emphasis, I know it's only we do, but because in general not as much emphasis is put on social and emotional learning, the break and lunch times can be the most taxing part of the day for children. So if you kind of wear that hat for a minute, put those goggles on and go, right, they've just been outside for a 20 minute break in the middle of the morning, and they have just been in the most intense social and emotional free-for-all that they are going to be in, you know, all morning. And then you sit back down and immediately expect them to have like a refreshed mental attitude, and that they will suddenly be ready for maths after break, as if their brain and all the glucose has not just been completely burnt out on negotiating that space, and the football hit me, and Sally wasn't very nice to me, and I don't know how to play that game anymore, and you know, and kind of weighing that in as of like, okay, well, what's challenging for you now? If you want break times to not be challenging, you have to give the children the skills for break times to not be challenging.
And the time as well. If you viewed social and emotional learning as on a par with maths, then you would observe lunchtime and playtime, and you would go, oh my gosh, they can't do it.
That kid is failing lunchtime. He's going to remedial lunch.
They can't play. So you would go, right, I'm going to scrap everything else and we're just going to concentrate on that. Until
fuck Egyptians.
Because and you would shift your whole perspective, but because it isn't valued and it's not seen because you're in the staff room, you know, well, maybe you are on duty, but you're on duty once a week or whatever, and you go, oh my gosh, this is just too big a problem for me to deal with because I don't have the freedom to say, okay, we need to put more play in for these like 8 and 9 year olds.
And it's a big ask in terms of, again, you know, we always talk about this with schooling, but you are such a small fraction of a child's, you know, life experience that if you, you know, you can't, I mean, Montessori, as I understand it, has lessons in how to interrupt adults that are talking, how to introduce yourself to whatever. But, you know, you could do that, but then children are going to go home and there's a whole different home experience in one way or another. But I think that's kind of one of the things, thinking about ZPDs, is you go off, it sounds very accusatory now, doesn't it? One goes off and has a 45 minute lunch break as a teacher, which obviously you get completely uninterrupted.
If you're lucky.
Right, I worked in a primary school. I used to leave the school site to maintain it. So I was like, you don't have to be on site during lunchtime. If I'm not on duty, I'm leaving.
If you work in an academy, you do have to be on site, lots of academies, and you have to be available to the children at all times. It's actually part of your contract.
Anyway, but you as an adult have had a break and a chance to mentally recharge and arrive back in the classroom. You have renewed some glucose and put some caffeine in one way or another, and they're going, right, I'm up for a challenging ZPD this afternoon, and the children are arriving going, right, we're fucked from lunchtime. We are burnt out.
We all know this, because if you worked in a classroom, you know those days, especially windy days. You know, the kind of like post lunch. You were talking about your putting on classical music, because I asked you the other day if you ever used to put music on in the classroom, and you were like,
social
only in a manipulating way. Put some classical music.
Just put on Eric Satie's Gymnopédies. It goes boom, bum, boom, bum. And I used to put it on, and I wouldn't mention it, and I would just have it on as a like subtle cue, and as I think of it, it's a bit more like when they used to play Britney Spears and the Teletubbies to get people out of, what was it? Was it Benghazi? They played really loud music so the soldiers couldn't sleep in the town.
Horrible.
It's more like that, you know, I'm socially manipulating the kids.
I used to do, like yoga breathing and meditation.
But that's more hands-on.
It's like, yeah, miss, brilliant.
My intention was to be like, Okay, the music is on in the background. I don't have to say... This is a whole other topic, but I firmly believe that no one has ever calmed down from being asked to calm down. It's the most infuriating thing. But putting some music on in the background, not mentioning it, and being like, there is a slow BPM, your heart rate will lower.
Yeah.
There is a soft tone, whatever. So I think we kind of talked around in a circle there about challenges and perseverance and finding things difficult. And I hope, actually, this is... I mean, I hope that we always have an impact, but I do hope that people go and reflect back on what is challenging for children, not just in terms of
and for you activity. I'm really interested in this for an adult perspective. I think it's if anyone has an example of you know, experiencing ZPD personally, either just in your own life or when you're being a practitioner, like for example when I was splitting the wood this morning and I suddenly went, do you know what, I could do this. So you showed me a new method of using the axe to split wood probably about 4 weeks ago now, and I did do it. I'm still not on a, but you know, I got the hang of it. But today, I tried it. I was just like, no, the universe is telling me to stop now. And there's a difference between perseverance and like getting that message from the universe about like, nah, I'm not going to do it. I am going to walk away, and I will try again. But today was not for me. Yeah.
And I'll stand next to you, and I'll go, you got this, mate.
Yeah, which is what you did.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. So if you've got any like. Interesting little
do you know what though I just anecdotes. When you said I'm interested in ZPD as an adult in my head do you ever have that thing where you like maybe it's a primary school thing but you laminated the pictures of the children's faces and you put them like above their pegs or on their plant pots or whatever and I immediately plotted a class in terms of like these children are easy to deal with, these children are challenging and I enjoy teaching them because it's a bit of a challenge. These children are well out of my ZPD and I cannot do it. But you don't get to walk away from it. It's it's that emotional thing, isn't it? Of going, you can't just go, he's too... I mean, you can to a point, but you know, it'd be interesting to go to a management meeting and just go, I really feel that Billy Bob is outside of my ZPD as a teacher. So
that's really good.
Could you move?
Help me.
If you're in the UK and you want to come down to Children of the Forest in person and do a little bit of training with us, we've got a load of dates on all the way through this next academic year. If you go to our Facebook page or our website, you'll be able to see all the dates and the titles of the courses and make sure you've got your ticket as soon as possible. They're all small groups so that we can do as much personalised learning as possible. In March, we've got a course on storytelling, music and drama. In April, a course in general outdoor learning involving a level 1 in forest school qualification. In May, we've got an outdoor cooking course. And in June, we've got an introduction to whittling. And if you feel like going for the big fish and you want to start your own forest school or become a qualified leader, in April this year we're starting our level 3 training courses. So you can come down to Children of the Forest for a whole week and spend some time with me and Gemma and learn how to run our very own forest school. So to find out all the dates and to get booked into those courses, go either to our Facebook page or to our website, which is childrenoftheforest.com.